With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Hello and welcome to Clash of the Titles, the podcast that sees two movies with something in common go head to head to see which one does it better. And welcome to part two of this week's epic face-off. On Monday's episode, we were reminded why you don't go into the sea, because that is the shark's house, with 1975's Jaws, which famously ran over schedule, taking a whopping 159 days to shoot. Well, today we meet our challenger, a film that can claim to have taken even longer to put together, because this adventure was 65 million years in the making. For the next hour, keep absolutely still. It's Visions Based on Movement from 1993. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to Jurassic Park.
Sorry, that was rubbish.
This is still the introduction. Quiet.
Sorry.
So, which movie will emerge the champion this week? Let's find out. It's Clash of the Titles.
Release the Kraken.
Hello, Clash Podders. I'm Alex Zane.
I'm Vicky Crompton.
I'm Chris Tilley.
Very quickly, don't forget you can follow us on Twitter at ClashPod for all sorts of extras about each movie we cover. And also, please take the time to rate and review us wherever you get your pods. So, Jaws versus Jurassic Park. As I said, we did Jaws on Monday. These were Victoria's choices. Reminders of the connection between Jaws and Jurassic Park. Victoria.
The connection is Steven Spielberg turns creatures from books into films set to music by John Williams.
Yep, it's factual. I covered Jaws, which means Jurassic Park fell into the lap of a one Christopher Tilley. Christopher, take us on a journey.
Jurassic Park is a tale of economic inequality, of the richest 1% owning half the world's wealth, and of dinosaurs eating people because John Hammond refused to pay Dennis Nedry what he's worth. Nedry is a brilliant computer programmer who can network 8 connection machines and debug 2 million lines of code. But Dennis is totally unappreciated in his time, and his appetite for food and Hawaiian shirts has landed him in financial bother. Billionaire John Hammond won't give him a raise, however, and refuses to discuss the matter. Left with no alternative, Dennis smuggles dinosaur embryos off the island in exchange for the money he deserves. Sure, his actions result in multiple violent deaths, but make no mistake, Dennis Nedry is the hero of Jurassic Park, with John Hammond's greed the real villain of the piece.
Did this movie touch a nerve about something that happened to you in life, Chris?
Pay people what they're worth. I also thought that everyone knows the plot of Jurassic Park, so I would go into more a theory of my own rather than the plot wholesale.
Made living biological attractions so astounding that they'll capture the imagination of the entire planet.
Dinosaurs and man, two species separated by 65 million years of evolution, just been suddenly thrown back into the mix together, how can we possibly have the slightest idea what to expect?
Hey, what'd I touch?
I didn't touch anything. We stopped. Anybody hear that? It's an impact tremor is what it is.
Maybe it's the power trying to come back on.
What the hell? What the hell? What the hell?
Fences are failing all over the park.
Are you hearing this?
The shutdown must have turned off all our fences.
I'm fairly alarmed here.
Hold on to your butt.
Oh, no.
Jurassic Park back online.
Yeah, that's nice. Gotta go.
Come on. We gotta get out of here.
The only thing that matters now are the people we love.
Which is just a delay. That's all it is. All major theme parks have delays.
Yeah, but John, if the Pirates of the Caribbean breaks down, the pirates don't eat the tourists.
So, first watch, people.
Yeah, I mean, I will say, just very quickly, I did think by the end, when John Hammond's like, this park hasn't worked. You're like, park was fine. If anybody actually hadn't hacked it, you wouldn't have had a problem. Like, it's a fairly good thing you've built here, John Hammond. I mean, ethically, there's a question, sure, but don't go blaming yourself for a T-Rex escaping. You weren't going to know the fat guy with the Hawaiian shirts, Dennis Nedry, was going to do this.
So when did you guys first watch this film, Vicky?
I went to the cinema to see it. It was a massive big deal and so exciting and not at all disappointing. Like a really fun childhood memory.
Alex?
It's a really weird one. I know I went to the cinema to see it, but I can't for the life of me remember the occasion or anything about it. So most of my memories come from ITV2, where it's like on
always
all the time. Yeah.
I remember the teaser, to be honest. It had such a brilliant teaser trailer. They didn't show you anything from the film. I didn't spoil anything. We'll post it, but just sort of gave you the setup. And obviously the name Spielberg kind of sold it and the concept. And I read the book before I saw it. I loved the book. Yeah, and I definitely remember going with my whole family to watch this and everyone loving it, apart from my mum thinking it was a bit gory. I went back a couple of times that summer. And I think it might be the most amazing experience I've ever had in the cinema. E.T. is the only one that comes close, and I was probably too young to appreciate that properly, whereas this one was just, it was just a magical experience.
I've just remembered I scuppered a few of the things in the movie for myself, because before the movie came out, they released a comic strip based on Jurassic Park, and I bought the comics because I was really excited about it beforehand. So I'm surprised I can't remember being in the cinema watching it. So I already knew some of what happened at the start of the movie, and it didn't play out exactly like it did in the comics that I bought, and that annoyed me a little. I was like, wow, even though the comics were based on the movie. Interesting. Other note, this sounds like you, one of your favourite cinema experiences are going up against one of my favourite movies of all time this week, which is a recipe for disaster. So, good news.
It's what makes The Clash exciting, Alex. So, a bit of background. The book was written by Michael Crichton, who was the king of high concept, and he'd actually already written Westworld, which was about the attractions in a theme park killing the visitors. So, he had form on this front. And the novel actually began as a screenplay in the early 80s about a student who recreates a dinosaur. But in his research, he realised that it would just be too expensive for one person to do, and that there was no real... He couldn't understand why they would do it. There was no need to do it. And so he put it on the back burner before deciding that it would emerge... The idea would emerge from a desire to entertain, leading to the theme park angle. But Spielberg was working a few years later, was working with Crichton on a movie script together that eventually became the TV series ER. And Crichton told him the story, and Spielberg saw it as his opportunity to make a good sequel to Jaws, is how he put it. So they made a verbal agreement for him to do it. But then Crichton's agent started a bidding war on the novel. And that was quite interesting. Warner Brothers tried to buy it for Tim Burton. Columbia tried to buy it for Richard Donner, and Fox tried to buy it for Joe Dante. So three quite different Jurassic Parks we could have ended up with. But while that bidding war was happening, Spielberg was already storyboarding scenes for what he'd want to do in a movie version because he was so confident, and he did end up that Universal bought the script for him.
And what did you think? Did you say you liked the book when you read it, Chris? Sorry,
I really enjoyed the book. I can't remember too much about it. I mean, I've gone on Wikipedia to have a little look at how similar or different it is, because I can't remember. And they're pretty close together, really. I mean, Crichton does write books that are quite cinematic. You know, there are exciting action set pieces in his book, so he thinks like a filmmaker.
Yeah, only because we did it with Jaws last episode. I think it's only fair to sort of point out some of the major differences that I remember between characters in the book and the film of Jurassic Park. I remember Gennaro, the lawyer, who's obviously the Weasley guy who gets munched in the movie. He's a lot more heroic in the book. He doesn't leave the kids in a car, for example, like the bad man that he is in the film. And also, the only other interesting bit that I have is Hammond is not as nice in the book, I don't think. He's a lot more cutthroat. He's less of a doddery old man who just sort of thought he was doing something nice. And he dies in the book, and the only reason I mention that is because he dies in the book in the same way that they saved his death in Jurassic Park, the novel, and used it for Peter Stormare, or however his surname is pronounced. I believe we've discussed this on the show before. His death in The Lost World is how John Hammond dies, with the little dinosaurs after he injures himself and can't move, and the little dinosaurs jump on him and chew him to bits. That's how Hammond dies in the book.
So Crichton turned in a script that no one liked, and then David Coate was brought in to throw out of all, basically what he did was throw out all of Crichton's characterization. He said whenever they started to talk about their personal life, you couldn't care less. And so he was there to sort of bring a bit of wit and humor to proceedings. So they got their script together. They employed a paleontologist called Jack Horner to try and back up some of their theories and to advise them. And then I guess the interesting behind the scenes story is with the technology. I won't go into detail because I don't know how interesting that is, but dinosaurs were previously created on screen using stop motion puppets, or even I've seen a couple of films where they attached prosthetics to lizards. Which they've not aged well. So they had 2 years to improve on that. They went to our old friend Stan Winston because of the Alien Queen in Aliens. And they said, we want you to make life-size dinosaurs. He said he could without knowing how. Phil Tippett came on board to craft stop-motion animation like King Kong, Ray Harryhausen, because they thought that would be the way they would create them. But it still looked jerky. He invented this go-motion technology with the puppets controlled by computers rather than hand, but that still didn't look right. And then, famously, Dennis Muren at ILM called and said he could pull off dinosaurs digitally. And Dennis Muren is another friend of the show because he created the stained glass window night in Young Sherlock Holmes.
Yay!
And he also worked
nostalgia.
On
nostalgia.
He worked
nostalgia for a previous Clash pod. That's a thing now.
So he animated a herd of Gallimimus skeletons running through a still photo of Hawaii. Apparently, when George Lucas watched that footage, he was crying. And the quote I've got from him is slightly bombastic. He said, it was like the invention of the light bulb or the first telephone call. Things were never going to be the same. It's not like that, though, is it?
No. Is it? Things were kind of the same, I think. Yeah. The dinosaurs look cool, but the world was the same.
Tippett saw the footage that they created of a T-Rex and famously told Spielberg, I think I'm extinct, which is a line that they used in the film. But they kept Tippett on board as an animator. So he worked together with Muren's computer artist and Stan Winston robotic team, and that's how they created these dinosaurs. It was a combination of all these different processes working together, which is why we've got effects that, you know, haven't dated all that badly compared to films that have come much more recently.
And that was the big thing, wasn't it? I mean, that, you know, although they never used it in the same way, like, for example, Superman used the tagline, you'll believe a man can fly. The whole, furore about this movie coming out was dinosaurs. Like, you're going to see dinosaurs that look like dinosaurs. We're almost going to, for the first time ever, see dinosaurs like on screen, which look like what dinosaurs would have looked like when they were alive. It was, that was the excitement as a kid anyway.
Yeah, it's difficult to state how a bigger deal it was, because we've had so many sequels to this film and, you know, CG is everywhere now. But at the time, this was a big selling point and a big moment of excitement to actually be in the cinema and see these, what they'd done. So the only other thing I was going to say beforehand is that Spielberg, when he finished the film, he wasn't there to edit it, because he went off to make Schindler's List. So he was having satellite conferences with the effects teams 4 times a week while shooting. And he said he found it a bipolar experience, bouncing between the Holocaust and dinosaurs. And he said it took every ounce of his intuition to make Schindler's List and every ounce of his craft to make Jurassic Park. So a pretty remarkable year in the life of a filmmaker, that one. So any more about
and
the
a
background?
Filmmaker, he's not short of a few remarkable years as in Spielberg. So the fact that this is, you know, I mean, he also made another movie, one of the greatest movies ever made, which I know we've talked about already this week, Jaws. So that was a remarkable year too. I mean, I'm just sort of adding a bit of parity to that. I don't want you to lean too heavily on Jurassic Park being a better film than Jaws. Just adding a bit of parity there. Carry on, Chris. Yeah.
Thanks, Al. So the movie, like Jurassic Park, we've got the cold open, haven't we? This is a dinosaur in a cage. Again, we don't see it either.
But you don't see it, and it drags him. So it drags the worker like up and down in the cage. Yeah, like Chrissy in the sea is dragged from side to side. It's the same.
There's your connection, Victoria. Why didn't you use that?
I forgot.
Yeah. And we also get to see that in Jurassic Park, in this world that Steven Spielberg has created, men can look hard and wear shorts simultaneously.
Absolutely. But shorts that are too short as well. And doesn't he have socks on? Hasn't he got knee-high socks on? Yeah.
Robert Muldoon, the game warden? Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Amazing.
He's helped by carrying a shotgun. So I guess if a man is wearing shorts, he should also carry a shotgun. And that offsets how not hard you look in shorts.
you know how a dog, an owner can start looking like their dog. Do you think, I feel like Muldoon starts looking like his prey, the Velociraptor, a little bit in this film.
Yeah.
Is that just me being an idiot?
No, he's got a great relationship with those raptors. I didn't want to say this now, but it's coming up naturally anyway. He's the only one in the whole park that seems to have understood that ostensibly the dinosaurs are girls. Everyone else forgets. We have a big scene in the lab. Oh, they're girls. Newman from Seinfeld says to a dinosaur, I thought you were one of your bigger brothers. Wrong. She hasn't got any brothers. She's only got sisters. And Sam Neill at some point says T-Rex, he wants to hunt. Wrong. That is a lady T-Rex. Get it fucking right. Right, it's done now. It's done. You can relax. Done. I just had to get that off my chest. Yeah. It was really annoying me. Sorry.
Do you know what? The fact that you've noticed something there, Victoria. Clever girl.
Ah! Thank you.
We've then got a series of conversations about lawsuits, safety concerns, inspections, investors. It's the insurance storyline, which it feels to me a bit like the trade deals at the start of Phantom Menace. It's not particularly exciting information. And I think the film does this a couple of times, actually, where we get bogged down in exposition, which isn't dinosaur related. but yeah, we then meet Ellie and Grant, played by Laura Dern and Sam Neill. And Grant's a fun character. He hates computers. He hates kids.
Sorry, I've just got written down. Sam Neill hates computers and kids, and that's his character arc right there.
And if I've got written down. That's how you talk to kids. I love it.
Well, first question: we meet him at a dig because he's a paleontologist. Why is there a little kid at the dig?
And I then don't know.
Why is Sam Neill abusing that kid with a claw and threatening to spill his intestines and telling him you'd still be alive when the Velociraptor eats you?
Genuinely, that you would, there'd be so many problems with that if Laura Dern didn't basically voice what everyone's thinking when she goes, "Why don't you just pull a gun on him?" You're like, "Thank you, Laura Dern," because that the fact that you've acknowledged that that might have been a bit much means we're going, "All right, cool." Because really, what the hell? Like, it's like pulling a knife out and going, "I could cut you if I wanted to, you little brat." I'm like, what?
And we also meet John Hammond, who
and John Hammond's accent, which needs a character in its own right. So where is he from?
So he's played by Richard Attenborough. The character was compared to Walt Disney at the time. Spielberg says that John Hammond is him, like he says Elliot is him and Peter Pan in Hook is him. He does this a lot. But he said in a way, Jurassic Park tells the story of any studio head having a bad year who needs a hit. And that's what he thinks John Hammond as. But also, I feel like in this day and age, he'd be an Elon Musk-like character, wouldn't he? He'd probably be a young, clever tech dude rather than an old ideas man.
Yes.
Yeah, that's interesting. Who? Yeah, okay, yeah. I like that, yeah.
I was thinking, well, because, you know, at that time, the billionaires were old men, whereas now the billionaires are kids, aren't they, basically?
Yeah. Yeah.
Anyway, just a thought. So let's get onto the island where we meet Ian Malcolm, a chaostician.
I love this guy. I want to know who does the PR for chaos people, because I think if you're a chaos theorist, scientist person, you don't look like that. You do not wear that much black. You don't wear cool glasses. You're a geek, but someone's gone, we can't have that on screen. So anytime a chaos theory person pops up, they're like this louche, super cool. He doesn't wear seatbelts because he's too fucking cool to wear a seatbelt of guy.
Sam Neill talks about him on one of the behind the scenes documentaries done sort of 20 years after us. And he says that he seems annoyed. He says in the script, Ian Malcolm was nerdy, but Goldblum turned up all buff. and then later in the film, when the T-Rex attacks, I believe Ian Malcolm in the script didn't really do a huge amount. But suddenly Sam Neill said, "What's he doing?" And Goldblum had spoken to Spielberg and got himself a hero moment. And so I think Sam Neill could see out the corner of his eye this guy absolutely stealing the film from under him, and he wasn't impressed.
Oh no, but
that
no. That's fair enough, because even in the film that you have on the screen, Jeff Goldblum doesn't fucking do anything. His whole arc is turn up, be a bit louche, get his leg bust, kind of in, that's it, the end. He doesn't have an arc of any sort. I know he gets one hero moment, but if he had to fight for that, imagine how shit it was for him before.
Yeah, and the film is, not getting ahead of ourselves as well. I think the second half of the film is weaker for Les Goldblum because he is like...
just lying on a table,
Yeah, he's a firecracker at the start. He's really, really good. Although I imagine he smelled.
Because of all the leather.
Yeah, absolutely. He must have known it was a tropical island. And did no one go, "Do you have a t-shirt with you or something?" Like, that's a leather jacket. And are those leather trousers?
So our scientists are in a jeep and they see the Brachiosaurus for the first time in the middle of a field. So this first big reveal happens in daylight. I have no idea how they were surprised by this huge dinosaur in the middle of a field. It sort of catches them off guard when they see it.
I thought of another connection between the films. When people are surprised and stressed, they take their glasses off. When they see the Brachiosaurus, they're like, "Oh my God, take my hat off. Oh my God, take my glasses off." And in Jaws, Hooper takes his glasses off when he gets stressed out. So it's just, you know, there you go. That's a Steven Spielberg tell for when people are stressed out and surprised.
All right, just to clarify, I didn't hate your connection that much, Victoria. You've got nothing to prove here. We are friends, all right? You don't have to improve on your connection. It was fine. It was just very fundamental. But you're right. And the look that Sam Neill, it's one of my favorite moments. Like whether or not he could have should have seen the dinosaurs before, my heart flutters when he takes the glasses off. He sells that moment as a guy who's studied dinosaur skeletons all his life, seeing a dinosaur for the first time. Perfectly. And the fact that Laura Dern's going, "This leaf shouldn't be here. This bloody leaf." And he's like, "Look over there, Laura. Yeah, dinosaurs."
Yeah, he captures that. So Sam Neill's capturing that, the sense of wonder that we're feeling as an audience. which helps make that work. And even when he says, oh, they're moving in herds, they do move in herds. You can sense his excitement. The script actually had the reveal a bit different, and it felt like a more Spielberg reveal, where they're in a forest and they're walking past a tree trunk and then another before realizing they are actually the legs of the dinosaur. But they changed this, and I've got no problem with it. I think it's one of the great, it's honestly think one of the great movie moments, being in a cinema, seeing that in 1993 was pretty special. But
well, exactly. I mean, it's the promise of the premise. You're there and you're like, I want to see dino. Oh my God, dinosaurs.
They've done it.
Ticks the box.
They've done it. And so I feel like the film could get going now, but instead we get a science lesson and then a tour and then a debate on the ethics of cloning, which is, it's fine and it's relatively interesting, but it's not what anyone's really signed up for with this movie.
It is now. Mr. DNA, he's my. I don't want to spoil it, but Mr. DNA is my MVW. He's brilliant. Hey, Mr. DNA, I love him. Why he didn't get a series off the back of this? I would watch a Mr. DNA cartoon. It's education and entertainment. It's edutainment, Chris.
This sequence also has something I noticed for the first time on this watch that completely shocked me, and it's something Gennaro says when he's referencing the animatronics. Do you want to say the quote, Alex? What the hell's going on?
I mean, I just watched Jaws and I was like, okay, so Spielberg likes his actors to ad lib, but you don't then keep them in. You go, yeah, that was rubbish. Do something else or nothing. Gennaro is looking at the scientists who are obviously human. There is no denying they are human. So let's take that into account to begin with. He's looking at human people. And then he says to John Hammond, he goes, are those characters auto? And you're thinking he's going for animatronic. And then he goes, are they auto-erotica?
No, he doesn't.
Auto-erotica.
What the hell is that doing in Jurassic Park? What the hell is that doing in Jurassic Park? I mean, I guess it's a joke. It's a weird joke. It's really adult and it's...
But the only joke it is him being an idiot. It's like, it's basically going, was there a shortage of lawyers in the world when this film was going to be released? So they were like, oh, we're killing the lawyer. So we need to add something else to make him killable. So if he's really stupid as well, like a bad lawyer, then we can definitely kill him. Because it's like, who goes to law school and then thinks human beings are autoerotica? That, imagine saying that sentence. Is that person an autoerotica? What do you mean? What do you actually mean? Are you mad? Are you a mad person?
In these conversations, we get some of the famous quotes from the film, like "Life finds a way." We get Ian Malcolm saying, "Your scientists were so preoccupied with whether or not they could, they didn't stop to think if they should." And we also get a weird critique of marketing and merchandising, and the evils of turning this into an attraction, which is interesting from a film that did historic deals with McDonald's, Kenner, Sega, and Ford. It feels like Spielberg's having his cake and eating it, and he even comes back to it later when the camera pans across all the merchandise they've done. It's like, what point are you trying to make here, you know? But very cleverly, you know, they were so on point here that the logo of the park in the movie became the logo of the film in real life. So the film's poster was a plot point in the movie. So smart minds at work with this. Another thing about Gennaro, do you not think they're telling us he's the villain by the fact he's wearing shorts with brown leather shoes? That's a villainous. Yeah, that's a villainous look, if ever I've seen one.
It's a strong look. I like the bit. Are you going to touch on the bit where they go into the lab and you see the little baby velociraptor being born?
No, go for it, Al.
I love that moment where the little baby velociraptor's born. I think, look, because again, it's a model, but I'm like, for me in that scene, that is a real dinosaur being born. And I like it up until John Hammond turns up and goes, oh, I told you to let me know when they were being born. I like to be here. I'm here for every creature that's born in the park because I'm the first living creature they come into contact with. So I imprint on them. It helps them to trust me. And you're like, what are you talking about? What on earth are you talking about? Like, no, yeah, shut up, John. Are you mad? Are you a mad person? You're not imprinting on them at all. It's not gonna, they're not gonna trust you. Have you wandered around your park having imprinted on some of these animals and gone, hello, me again, I imprinted on you? No, you'd be dead.
We're now 45 minutes into the film and they decide to give us a lecture on chaos theory. So we're still learning rather than watching. But then we the team stumbles across the sick Triceratops, which looks real, I think. I mean, it took 11 puppeteers in an underground pit controlling it, but obviously this is a practical effect, and I think that seems really effective.
Agree. Up until the poo, the piles of poo. I'm not even doing a joke. I genuinely think you're absolutely right. The Triceratops is brilliant. When they go to look at the poo, I'm like, I don't understand why the poo piles are that big. Like, because those poo piles are too big to have come out of the Triceratops themselves. They're like perfect pyramids of poo, and they span higher. The Triceratops would have to get its bum in the air, like stand on a stool to poo that high, which means that someone is out there piling up dinosaur poo in the park, which seems like a ridiculous job to have to do. Just let them poo. You don't have to then pile it up. Why are the poo piles that high?
It's a great question. Okay.
The Triceratops as well. Can I talk about a tweet I did, if that's all right?
We don't have a... What's our policy? Sorry, just to check. What's our policy on cross-promotion? I haven't got it in front of me.
I've just brought up our guidelines. Let me just scan through them here. I've got the document.
Yeah.
Vicky can talk about tweets because she doesn't have a Twitter account. Alex's Twitter account is brilliant, @Alex_Zane. sorry, it's just sort of... We never got round to you, Chris. Let's judge it on this.
It's an anniversary tweet. I from the day we're recording this, I tweeted this 5 years ago today on June the 9th, 2015. And it's...
No!
It's my most viral tweet, and it's due with Jurassic Park. It had 2,000 retweets and 2,500 likes. Do you know who Joyce Carol Oates is?
Yes.
No. So she's a literary icon. She's written 58 novels. She's won countless awards. She's this real intellectual. I tweeted a picture of Steven Spielberg next to the Triceratops from behind the scenes because I thought it looked a bit like those awful safari trophy killing photos that were going around at the time. And so I wrote, this guy thinks it's cool to kill defenseless animals, then take a selfie. Jerk. That's what I wrote. Mm-hmm. Joyce Carol Oates responded by saying, so barbaric that this should still be allowed. No conservation laws in effect wherever this is, ? Went viral. But it's not really the fact that it went viral that's interesting. It then turned into a news story that The Guardian, Newsweek, The Huffington Post, USA Today, Entertainment Weekly, they all wrote articles with the headlines to the effect of Joyce Carol Oates thinks Steven Spielberg killed the dinosaurs.
I
saw that tweet. I remember. I think when I was researching this movie, I remembered that tweet and thought, oh, maybe I'll mention that. And then it seemed too late. I didn't realize that was your tweet. That was hilarious.
I actually felt guilty afterwards because but it's not my fault if this woman's stupid. she then tried to claim she then backtracked by saying that she was in on the joke and she was making a joke herself, but. Too late. The cat was out of the bag.
They no one ever hears about the explanation. It's too late by that point. Late. People only hear about the accusation. Yeah. Oh, wow. That's great.
All right, back to the film. And we're in the T-Rex attack moment. Oh, no, sorry. We do have the you didn't say the magic word, which is
God.
Something happens on the computer. And I still see that and hear that in my brain sometimes when I get a password wrong.
we should also talk about the fact that as they're approaching the Tyrannosaurus Rex paddock, you know, we do have Robert Muldoon looking hard as nails in shorts and without a shotgun at this point going, quiet, all of you. They're approaching the Tyrannosaur paddock. And you're like, this park seems incredibly dangerous. Like, everyone seems to be like, this isn't a safe place to have sent kids out in a car to explore.
No, by themselves, basically.
Yeah, exactly. You've got Samuel L. Jackson after it all kicks off, and he's like they have to bring them back. This is before the T-Rex attack. He's going, it could have been worse, John. It could have been a lot worse. And you're like, well, then don't put them out there.
Yeah, like, and also it's your grandkids, and you don't really seem to give a shit. There's two things. Samuel Jackson's got to stop smoking, or we've got to stop doing this podcast, because I don't know how I'm supposed to ever quit smoking, because we watched too many films from the 90s where people smoke in the most inappropriate setting constantly, and it drives me insane. And second of all, it's the raptors. Like, when I was little, I hated the raptors because they were a distraction from the T-Rex, but they're watching it now, I get it, because they're more affordable to be able to have running around the place, and they are very lethal. As Robert Muldoon says, they're smart, they're fast, they're lethal. Begs the question, how are they going to function in a theme park setting at all? Like, what is the point of having them if all
No, I wrote down exactly the same thing. I went, when they go to the Velociraptor cage to see the Velociraptors in its feeding time, and they put the cow in, and like all you see, and that is the exhibit. That is where people who have paid £10,000, $10,000 a ticket are going to go, great, we get to see the Velociraptors. And all it is some bushes moving. Like, you've filled it with bushes. You can't see a single thing. And I'd be like, give me my fucking money back. This isn't called Moving Tree Park. Yeah. I didn't come to see some trees move. Yeah, that's terrible. And on the smoking thing, I think you're wrong. I nearly gave up smoking because what the hell? Has Samuel L. Jackson ever... He's smoking the filter.
I noticed that. It's disgusting.
It makes me feel sick. And it's not like... I get it. You're saying, oh, he's stressed, so he's just smoking. And you're like... He is a smoker, though, so he must know that he's just smoking a filter. And it's not like he has it. It's not like he goes, shit, I'm smoking the filter, and puts it out. He takes a puff on the filter. He, like, sucks chemical filter and goes, yeah, John, we need... And you're like, this is... are you mad?
Okay, I'm finished.
Right, let's talk about the T-Rex attack, but let's talk about it after this quick break.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
He just says, how many holes does a straw have? 0, 1, or 2? The internet can't figure it out, so I've done what any sane person would do. Ask the Luke and the Pete.
Join me, Pete Donaldson, and Luke Moore for an unplanned half hour every Monday and Thursday as we talk about, well, anything really, from your emails to life's great mysteries to this guy.
The noise you're going to hear sounds like a man being interrupted by a car. He isn't being interrupted by the car. He is making the car sound.
Sina, that's a hippie.
Por qué?
Beep, 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 on earth is he doing that? Beep, 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 beep. How does he make that noise? Listen now on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Beep, 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 beep.
The Luke and Pete Show is a Stakhanov production.
And we're back, right, the T-Rex attack. So this is a perfect combination, I think, of the practical and the digital effects here. And it's a real masterclass from Spielberg in escalation of action and drama and violence and horror. He got the idea for the rumbling, telling them whether the dinosaur was coming, from sitting in his car and listening to Earth, Wind and Fire at full volume, apparently. And it was making his rearview mirror shake. And so he wanted to use it in the movie, and it ended up being one of the toughest things for them to figure out. They couldn't figure out how to make the glass of water vibrate in the way that Spielberg wanted to do it. And eventually one of the tech guys realized that by playing a guitar at the right frequency, they could control the vibration. So there's someone underneath that car strumming a guitar in that scene.
That's a brilliant fact.
But it's never has a glass of water been so terrifying. Yeah. That is a terrifying
and it's
glass of water.
And that's like a proper trailer moment. I think by this time they were really thinking about the trailers when they were making the movie. You know, a couple of Samuel L. Jackson lines were perfect for the trailer. And that scene is the way you start a trailer, isn't it? But you're talking about them, you know, in the Jaws episode, Al, you were talking about the fact that what were they thinking, putting this mechanical shark in the water? Well, here, Spielberg decided halfway through the shoot he wanted this scene to happen in the rain at Universal Studios and the studio that they'd built, but they weren't waterproof, the dinosaurs, so they literally had no idea if they would function. And if you look at behind the scenes shooting of the film, Stan Winston's people have got brooms and towels just drying the dinosaur between each shot because they literally didn't know what would happen if they got too wet. So,
and they'd not thought of a giant dinosaur umbrella, so there's a problem. Yeah.
And also, did no one say to Spielberg, "Do you remember Jaws? Yeah. Do you want to
remember
live
all that
again?
Water? Yeah, and that was stressful, wasn't it? Take your glasses off. It was that stressful.
I want it to be raining, but I want it to be really salty rain. Stephen, stop it.
So the sound of the T-Rex, they used a crocodile, a lion, but actually the bulk of the sound of that roar is a baby elephant screeching, which I was.
Oh, why
expecting.
Is he screeching? Oh,
because Spielberg was burning it. Spielberg was burning it at the time. It set fire to its tail.
Yeah, Victoria, you can do a lot of things, but you cannot lie. No one, and I do mean no one who's ever listened to this podcast before was convinced that you go, "Oh, what was happening to the baby elephant?" No one believed that. You couldn't sell it. You couldn't even begin to sell it.
Okay. But this is a solid 10 minutes of proper excitement. Do you think this still is effective 27 years on, this sequence?
I think it's brilliant that they try to, basically, this, it sounds awful, but they try to kill the kids first, because you're watching it as a child and it's clear that the director is not going to like make you feel safe, because the T-Rex, you know, with the plexiglass, with the roof of the car coming through and they're sort of trying to kick it, whatever, that says, "I will kill these children if I want to," which is a really good way as a child to make you think, "Oh, all right, we're in for it here." The only thing I've got confused is when the little boy, Timmy, is trapped into the car, it sort of spins around and around. And I thought, why did that not rip his leg off? But maybe that I'm nitpicking, I suppose.
Yeah. I think you are a bit... I loved it. I mean, the only thing I felt this time watching it, and it is still just... I think you're absolutely right. It's a phenomenal sequence. The matching up of animatronics and CGI and everything, it's so good, is like... Dr. Grant and Dr. Malcolm are in no hurry to help those kids.
No,
like,
they're not.
A lot of shit goes down and they sit there and sort of wipe the condensation of the glass and peer through it. At which point the T-Rex has got its mouth in the car and the kids are screaming for their lives. And they're like, "Do you want it?" I thought you were going to... I was waiting for you to... Shall we? I guess we should. So like, get out there.
One thing I do wonder about, though, is the lawyer, Gennaro, gets eaten while he's sitting on a toilet, which is kind of played for laughs. And some of this stuff is then intercut with Dennis Nedry's death, and which he hits his head, and it's all quite slapstick. And I don't know if it's the most the Jurassic Park I want to see, where it's slightly slapstick and funny, and the deaths are played for laughs and are quite broad, rather than being proper horror.
I don't know. I think when you were younger, like, I remember what we talked about when we were younger, having seen it, was the frill neck dinosaur, and he tries to feed it. Doesn't he try and give it a chocolate bar or something? And we thought that was brilliant because it is funny, but it is also quite scary because it obviously just gets like torn to bits in the car.
Yeah, I kind of feel that I know it's not scary in the classic horror sense, Gennaro's death, but for me, like, it's up there with Jack Palance dying in a dressing gown in Batman. Like, wearing shorts on a toilet and meeting your death is like, I do not want to go like that. That is embarrassing.
Undignified, isn't it? You've got a little bit later, there's sort of an addendum to this scene where the dinosaur's chasing Jeff Goldblum, Ian Malcolm, on the back of the Jeep. He does a rearview mirror gag, which he did in Close Encounters. He has a rearview mirror gag where Dreyfuss thinks it's a car behind him, the lights, and so he waves the car on, and then the lights go up in the air. So he's good at those. And I find it a bit disappointing that the T-Rex just gives up. That's how they get away from the T-Rex, is it just calls it a day.
But that's realistic, I think, because... It can't, yeah. Well, I tell you what, there's a lot of debate in these dinosaur fact books that are in my house about how fast a T-Rex could actually run. And I've got one book that says a T-Rex...
32 miles an hour. It tells you in the movie.
Yeah, but that's like... I can't do maths, but it's more than 20 years... Oh, shit, is that right? It's from 1993. So the stuff that they
Years are a measurement of time, and miles an hour are a measurement of speed. So that's why... That's why you've scuppered yourself there already.
In spite of the fact they had Jack Horner sitting in the corner and that's made me laugh. Giving them direction on this film. It does merge eras and creatures, and it's not particularly realistic, some of the traits have and the deaths and stuff. So just got to suspend your disbelief for this one rather than saying a T-Rex wouldn't run that fast or that slow.
No.
What do your books say, Victoria?
70 kilometers an hour, which I think is 50 miles an hour, but I don't know if that's right. Anyway, what I was going to say was Jeff Goldblum. So this is what they thought in 93. I presume they thought it was true, but in these dinosaur books I've got, it's not true. Jeff Goldblum says nature picked dinosaurs for extinction. That is wrong. It was a meteor in Mexico. Like Timmy says, like that's just a fact. They weren't selected for extinction. A meteor blocked out the sun. The plants died. The plant-eating dinosaurs died. The meat-eating dinosaurs died. There you go.
Clever girl.
Have they confirmed it? I thought there were so many different theories. Is that now... Have they all decided on the meteor theory? I thought it could have been anything from, like, mammals, like loads of new mammals eating dinosaurs' eggs as food, or like the change in the temperature of the planet, or
because of the meteor. I mean, these books, I don't know how rigorous their fact checking is because they're for 5-year-olds, but they are going really strong on the meteor theory.
Right. Okay. And for what age group did you say these are? University paleontological books?
No, these are for 3 to 5-year-olds.
Okay. Well, good. It's a good theory.
Moving on, we find out that the dinosaurs are changing sex, and that is how life found a way, thanks to the amphibian DNA. We get a lovely shot of Jeff Goldblum reclining with his shirt wide open, which has become a famous image.
So hot.
It is.
Goddamn hot.
And we've
I
got...
I mean, I would say, pause, check that out.
And we've got Timmy flying off an electrified fence, which is an endlessly amusing image.
But why doesn't it kill him instantly?
It does. He's dead.
No, but he's not dead, is he?
He is. He stopped breathing and everything. He's proper dead. That's why Sam Neill... If Sam Neill just kissed him, that's a different film, Victoria. He's giving him mouth to mouth.
Yeah, but his brain should be like fucking vegetable soup. Like, it shouldn't have a brain left because he should be beyond resuscitation. It's 10,000 million... Now, wait, I don't know my measures of electricity. Hertz?
What do your books say? What do your books say about it, Victoria? Why don't you go back to your books?
I'll put it on Twitter. I won't.
Let's move on to the Velociraptor attack in the kitchen, because that is the other big action set piece.
Wait, can we talk about one thing, which is one thing that bothered me this time that I hadn't noticed before, is the bit where it's just sort of casually dropped into conversation at the hour and a half mark in the movie, of a 2-hour movie with 30 minutes to go. They mention verbally, there's no sort of visual evidence of this, they go, oh yeah, Lex is a hacker.
Oh my God, thank you. It's so frustrating. It's so important. Yeah. And Timmy goes, well, at least you're not on your computers like usual. She's like, shut up, Timmy. What is that? Are you kidding me? Bearing in mind what comes up later, all you had to do is have her on a little video console thing when she's coming into whatever. And he's like, put it down. You're always on that. Job done.
Right.
Just get it done. It's so frustrating.
She's a hacker, which, again, may come in useful later. There's a bit in Jurassic World which does exactly the same thing. And you sort of expect it a bit more from Jurassic World. You don't expect it from Jurassic Park, but in Jurassic World, the kids in that find a Jeep, an old gas-powered Jeep from the original movie that we're talking about now, and they want to use it. And one of them just goes, we need to jumpstart it. Remember, like we used to with Grandpa's car.
Perfect.
In the garage.
And you're like, great.
What? Come on.
That'll do. Yeah.
The Velociraptors in this sequence are one of the reasons Spielberg wanted to make the film. He wanted to see prehistoric creatures in a modern setting, in a lab, in a kitchen. And I think there's a similarity with Gremlins here a little bit, with the chaos. You're seeing these very unusual creatures causing chaos in a domestic environment. But yeah, again, this is a melding of all these different technologies. So early on in this scene, it's actually a bloke in a suit. I don't know if you've seen the behind the scenes of the poor bloke trying to walk in this Velociraptor suit, kind of in a crouch. He had to train for months in sort of a skiing crouch, and then they would have to hang him up from the ceiling between takes because he couldn't come out of the outfit and he couldn't stand up.
Oh my God.
But there's great footage of the pre-production meetings of Spielberg just with the puppeteers and the technical team saying, oh, wouldn't it be great if he could just like tap his toenail? That would be a really effective thing. And all these ideas that are coming out of him that end up in the movie. One thing they wanted was the Velociraptor to stick its tongue out like a snake. And that's when James Horner in the corner told them no, that they were more, you know, he's the one that kept pushing that they're more like birds than snakes.
I've got another fact. It's now accepted that Velociraptors had feathers. That's a fact. I can prove it. I can't prove it right now because it's in the book, but that's a fact. They had feathers. They weren't just like birds. They were just like birds and they had feathers. Fact!
They were very much like turkeys, weren't they? I think that's the comparison that gets made by actual paleontologists, that they were the turkey of the dinosaur world.
Yes.
We should give a lot of credit to one of our major sources of information on this episode, which is my first big book of dinosaurs.
That's so, literally what it's called, yeah.
And the bit where the Velociraptor breathes on the glass is very cool. I love that bit where it like huffs and the glass steams up. I think that's great.
And it mistakes a reflection for being Lexi, which really it confuses you in the audience for a brief second. You're as confused as the Velociraptor is to that moment. So it's one of those clever Spielberg.
That's the best bit.
Conceits.
And it feels in this like the kids are making the most of the environment to try and survive in a very believable way. I love it and I like it, and I hate the evolution of this scene in Jurassic Park 2, The Lost World, when the kid uses gymnastics to kill a Velociraptor because you've taken what is one of the scariest recent cinema monsters and you've had a kid use gymnastics to kill it. And no.
And they were the breakout stars of this movie. You know, we all went to Jurassic Park to see a T-Rex, and then you ended up coming away talking about the Velociraptor. So,
no, not me. I was about the T-Rex. I don't mind this kitchen scene, but for me, this everything after the T-Rex in this movie is not as good. This movie hits its high note too early for me. It's so good, that T-Rex attack, that I feel like it's entertaining, but there is nothing in the second half of this movie that comes close to the T-Rex. Well, not this kitchen attack. Not nothing.
Well, we're at the climax now. And so the finale has them being attacked in the lobby of Jurassic Park by the Velociraptors. And then the T-Rex shows up. And that's when our villain becomes our hero and saves the day. We've got the hero shot with the him doing a King Kong roar and the banner saying when dinosaurs ruled the earth falling behind him. It happens very fast. It's a fantastic image, but it's a slightly abrupt ending, I think. Thoughts on that?
I agree with you, actually. It just sort of ends, and then they try and wrap up the fact that Sam Neill likes kids now, so that just clears up that arc. But it's even though I think it's a little bit too long as a film, but you're like, oh, right, okay, we're just off now. That's it.
Yeah. I'm from a standpoint where I was sort of waning in the second half of this film, so I was happy for it to wrap up. I mean, I know I'm being down on the kitchen attack, and I would say there is one scene where they climb into the vents, which is really good. Like, let's escape into the vents, and the Velociraptors are down below. I do think it's unnecessary for Sam Neill to kick the ladder away after they've climbed into the vents. Like, he's like, ah, you think you're going to climb up this ladder and follow us? Not a chance. But then it's just like, what? But the weird bit is, the good bit rather, is that bit where Lexi falls through the vent and the Velociraptor's below her and it's like lying prone for a moment. You see it trying to get back to its feet to get her and they pull her up. That is an absolutely beautiful shot.
Yeah, it is.
And that's one of the first times they used face replacement technology in a movie, because that was a stunt woman doing that. And the stunt woman accidentally looked at the camera. And so that they digitally put the actress's face on the stunt woman, which is obviously really normal, par for the course now. But that was the first time I think that was used. So, yeah, and then weirdly, Ellie and Grant are in the chopper leaving and they look really happy. They're really having a laugh and smile. And I don't know what they're so happy about.
I've went round and round with this because I was like, oh, I hate it in anything when a woman catches a man being like the most basically sort of being civil to children. It's like, oh my God, he's incredible. Whereas a woman is expected to be nice to kids all the time. So all he's doing is let these kids have a nap on him. And that's okay. Like, I don't think that shows that much love, but she's like, are we going to have children now? And I think it's too much. But then I thought I'm possibly overthinking this a little bit. And they are trying to tie up that arc of like he hates kids and now he doesn't hate kids, and it's fine to do it like that, but it just annoyed me a bit that she's like, the way she looks at him, she's like, you are gonna get you some and then some because you let some kids have a hug. Weird.
Okay, should we do the bits?
why does that make you so uncomfortable? But anyway, we'll talk about it later.
Should we do the bits?
Yes.
Yeah.
All right. Alex, favourite scene?
The T-Rex attack. It is the greatest scene in this movie. It's brilliant. The use of animatronics, the CGI, the glass of water, the flares, the keep absolutely still. It's visions based on movement. Everything about that scene. It's what I paid my dollar for to go and see this movie, and it delivered on that dollar. It's just a problem that it's too good for the rest of the film afterwards.
Vicky.
Let's hack the mainframe, which is a really stupid scene to pick, but I've just got a disproportionate nostalgia, affection and love for the scene where Lexi says it's a Unix system and restarts the system by using a filing system on a computer that doesn't use the alphabet, that relies on you knowing the geography of the park so that you can move your mouse around the files to find the bit that you want. And it takes about 20 minutes, which is ridiculous.
Lock the doors, Lexi. Lock the doors, Lexi. Lock the doors.
And since we're talking about nostalgia for previous episodes of this podcast, which we've done, which is taking nostalgia to new levels, you know I have a weakness for this sort of thing, which is why I love Sandra Bullock's The Net as much as I do. Like, when a character sits down and says, let's hack into the mainframe, I am 100% behind you. I think it's brilliant.
I fucking love Timmy flying off the electric fence. I've already said that. I could just watch that on a loop. It's so funny. This poor little kid flying through the air. It could only have been made funnier if he was dead, as you said, Vicky. But
That electric fence provides a couple of great moments because Sam Neill pretending to these terrified children that he's been electrocuted is a killer gag.
It's a I thought that, what a brilliant bit of writing that is. That's a really funny thing to think of.
Was it, just a very quick one, I read somewhere that Harrison Ford was considered for the role before Sam Neill, which I think would have also worked.
Yeah, they've just, in the last couple of years, they've said that. No one's really gone on that. No one's really said why he turned it down, but he said he didn't want the role. So,
fine.
Yeah, all right, I'll do. I was gonna agree with you, Al, with the T-Rex attack as my favourite, but fuck it, let's have Timmy flying off the fence. MVW, most valuable whatever. Vicky, what's yours on this one?
Bob Peck as Robert Muldoon, even though his shorts are too short, he seems to be the only person taking the fact that there are dinosaurs, literal dinosaurs, around seriously, and he does a very good job of that.
Alex.
Clever girl. Yes, mine is Jeff Goldblum. This is going to piss you off, Victoria. For all the reasons Victoria doesn't like him, I love him because I think, you know, in that role, the kind of like the science bod, the fact that he's a freaking rock star and a scientist, I think is great. I'm like, wow, I've not seen a cool scientist since Hooper in Jaws, who I sort of identified with and went, he's funny and cool. And I like that. So, yeah, it's, you know, yes, too much leather for a tropical island. But that aside, he's a good one. Good guy. Great guy.
Well, for me, I'd never heard of a Velociraptor, like a lot of people, I think, before I saw this film. So, and I think what's so effective about them is the fact that you have this problem with Godzilla and King Kong sometimes and the T-Rex. The size of it makes it hard to make them a threat up close. And so here you've got a monster that's in the eye line pretty much of the heroes of the piece. So I think they work really well. So I had the Velociraptors and then I realized, why are you putting the Velociraptors? So I'm going to have the people who made the Velociraptors, the technicians behind it, because I think they did a really good job of creating a new movie monster. And that kitchen scene is, I still think, holds up. So,
if anyone has experienced the Velociraptors and loved them and never made it to Jurassic Park 3, I would suggest never watching that if you want to keep Velociraptors as a sort of scary thing in your head. Because what you never want to see, as Jurassic Park 3 shows us, is a Velociraptor sitting in a plane seat, turning to Sam Neill going, hello, Alan.
And what would you change, Alex?
So I've actually got one, like, and it's based on what I've been moaning about, which is the fact that the T-Rex bit is like so good, and I want more T-Rex. And I know we see it with the Gallimimus, which I think is a really great moment that we didn't mention, where it just bursts out of the tree line and grabs one of them. I'm like, oh, it gives me chills, the T-Rex, much more than the Velociraptor. So I actually think, in terms of the perimeter fence with Joe Mazzello when he's on the fence and the threat being Laura Dern is going to turn it on while he's still holding on to it, I think that the T-Rex should appear at that point while he's still on the fence and be too scared to get off and start coming towards him. So like the T-Rex is coming to grab him and Laura Dern's turning the switches, and in the end the electricity blows him off the fence, so you still get your favourite moment, Chris, and it blows him out of the T-Rex's reach, and it's like the electricity comes back, meaning the T-Rex can't get through the fence to the others on the other side. So yeah. I want the T-Rex in that scene.
That's a good idea.
Vicky?
It would be Dickie Attenborough, John Hammond. He either needs to be nicer and be more bothered about his grandchildren, or, as you said, he is in the book, really awful and completely unbothered, but he's sort of in the middle. Like, he doesn't mention it enough times. Like, he should be very, very, very worried that his grandchildren are in the park and the dinosaurs are loose, but he doesn't seem to care. And then he cares right at the end where he's like, are the children all right? But it's a bit too late by that point. So it could just be a total shit and not care, or be a nice, lovely granddad and be more bothered.
Have you ever seen Brighton Rock, the version of that with Richard Attenborough as Pinky?
Yes. Yeah.
I think he should have channeled that performance, because he is terrifying in that film. And you think of him as this kindly old granddad-like character when he's old, but he could do nasty if he wanted to. So yeah.
Yeah.
Give us a bit of Pinky. In terms of...
Is he Scottish in it?
Yes, he is. No, he is supposed to be Scottish. Right. His accent's bad and your accent's worse.
That's true.
We've spared no expense.
So in terms of changes, screenwriter David Koepp, I've heard him talking about this. He's been criticized heavily for how long it takes for the film to properly get going, and he reckons on his tombstone it will say it took too long to get to the island.
Yes,
because people keep saying that, Tim. But for me, there's one thing I noticed that I think could be removed. There's too many limps in this film. John Hammond has a limp at the start. Ellie develops a limp. Timmy develops a limp. And Malcolm develops a limp. So you got four limps, yes, by the end of this movie. That's too many limps.
Laura Dern's limp is the worst. That bit where she's limping out of that. I don't understand what. I don't think you really see what happened to her. And I don't. For me, a lot of it is like that is the limp I adopted when I was in Dawn of the Dead. Zack Snyder's Dawn of the Dead. I don't know if I've mentioned that on the show before, but when I was a zombie in Dawn of the Dead, Zack Snyder's Dawn of the Dead, I gave myself a limp. And when I see Laura Dern's limp, I'm like, that's the limp I gave myself that I was told to not do.
Oh, really? So, when you see Oscar winner Laura Dern's limp, you think that's like my limp. Okay.
It's a weird moment, though, because I think she's great in this, but the moment where she's like coming, like she's got this really good, and he sort of runs. She's like, run! I'm like, wah! I don't like the way she shouts at Sam Neill to run, because he's not on the same page as her as well. He's sort of like, oh.
No, she's not saying it to him. She's saying it to herself because she's scared. She's like, just run, as in get to Sam Neill, because she's hurt her leg.
No, she's saying it to him. Anyway, whatever she's doing, she needs to open her mouth in that scene, because it's all sort of said through, like, there's a lot of sort of spittle through teeth, like, run! And I'm like, bleh.
What a director you would be. Laura, can you do it again? Could you open your mouth this time?
Hey, I'm saying she's great in it. I just don't like the limpy run. I'm not a fan of that. And run! It's a bit weird.
Yeah, no limpy run, no spitty mouth, fine.
I think these are great directions, by the way. If I was Laura Dern and I watched my performance back, and I'd be like, why did no one tell me about my spitty run and my limpy limp? I'd be like, could someone... If I'd been there, Laura... Hey, how you doing? Alex, sorry. I do a podcast. If I'd been there, I'd have told you that. So there you go. I sit down?
No. I'm kind of regretting bringing up the limps now. My actual change, though, I think... when I was 15 years old in 1993, this was the perfect version of this film for me. But now I would love to see an 18 rated version of this film with proper horror, gore, porn. You know, violence and a bit of porn. Yeah, I think I'd like to see, you know, not playing that. No, don't play the kills for laugh. Do the horror version of this. I think I'd get a lot out of that.
And more deaths. I think more people should die. I think they should, like, I think we should stock up on, like, henchmen or like more staff to just get munched. Also, I'd like to see Samuel L. Jackson get attacked on screen. I just want more dinosaur. I think you're right. A bit more dino on human action in a horror sense specifically.
Or a porn sense. Am I right?
Clever girl.
Oh, God.
It's the gift that keeps on giving. Right. Has that drawn a line under Jurassic Park, Christopher?
Yes. Yes. And I think if we're coming to the verdict, I think clearly, Alex, you need to say your opinion first, as it seems like we know where that one's going.
You want answers?
I think I'm entitled.
You want answers?
I want the truth!
Well, opinion seems like a grand way of saying one word. Jaws. Obviously, it's my favourite film of all time. It is the reason I love cinema. So now I'm actually explaining more. I was just going to say Jaws, so I've messed up, but it was going to be quite like effective Jaws like that. Hey, yeah, I love Jaws. It's the reason I'm sitting here doing this podcast with you guys. It was the film that made me love cinema and made me realise the power that film could have, possibly in a massive negative way for me. Like you say, Victoria, you said on Monday, I've never either made love in the sea or weed in the sea. Not at the same time, separately. So, Jaws.
You've also never swum in the sea. I think we should say that as well. That's kind of the sex and the pissing. The sex and the pissing should
that
be left.
I'm quoting. That wasn't mentioned on Monday.
And I will tell you for a fact, 50% of the people that are in the sea are there to have a wee. They're not there to swim because it's difficult to get to the toilet when you're on the beach. Everyone knows that. Yeah, in fact, most of the time, I only go in the sea to have a wee.
That's and the other 50% are in the sea to have sex. That's what you get at a beach. That's why I don't go to beaches, because it's either people having sex or pissing in the sea. That's all.
Exactly. Exactly.
Right. Victoria, what's your vote in the verdict this week?
Do you want me to go last because I picked the films, which was a point Chris made last week, which is a really excellent point.
Okay, okay. Chris, do you want to throw your hat into the proverbial ring?
Well, I love the fact that the story is so simple in Jaws and it's got that classics hero's journey. As I said on Monday, that perfect dramatic triangle really makes that final hour. But Jurassic Park, you've got the thrills, but you've also got all that technology. Like, the film started a proper paradigm shift in the industry, you know, from practical to CGI, and from actually larger one, from movie stars to special effects became the movie stars. So, as we said, and Vicky keeps bringing up, there's lots of similarities between these films. I think there are some fundamental differences that help make up my mind, though. You've got shocking kills versus funny kills. You've got no exposition versus tons of exposition. You've got an invisible foe versus multiple monsters filling the screen. Against any other summer movie, I think Jurassic Park could win, but ultimately Jaws is why every blockbuster is chasing. That's what they're going for, which is why my vote goes to Jurassic. No, it goes to Jaws.
Yeah! Woo, woo, woo! Victoria, close us out. What would yours have been?
Well, Jurassic Park is closer to my heart, but Jaws is the better film, so Jaws.
3-3. I'm so happy. Oh, thank you, guys. Jaws is the winner on this week's Clash of the Titles. So let's look ahead. Victoria, I know you need to go because I can hear children in the background. And, you know,
yep.
You've got to go climb some perimeter fences.
They're coming in here to correct all your dinosaur facts. I can hear them scratching at the door, going on about feathers.
I'll be very quick then. The clue I gave you at the end of last week's episode for what this or next week's episodes are, the Clash next week. The clue was American High School is bloody awful if you're not one of the good-looking kids.
John Hughes, John Hughes. Kids. Is it John Hughes? Is it John Hughes?
It's not John Hughes.
No.
And the actual answer is Heathers versus Mean Girls. Ooh. On next week's Clash of the Titles. Ooh. Christopher, you get Heathers.
Ooh.
And
yay!
Mean Girls goes to Victoria. We'll
brilliant.
Be back next week doing Heathers and Mean Girls. In the meantime, get in touch on Twitter at ClashPod or email us, which is show@clashpod.com. And please do rate and review us on Apple or Spotify, wherever you get your podcasts, and subscribe to us and the rest. We love it. Thank you so much for listening. Back on Monday. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
This was a Stakhanov production.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I'm Kate Thornton. Join me every week on White Wine Question Time, the podcast that asks famous faces three thought-provoking questions over three glasses of wine.
It's very rare to be introduced with such a thorough introduction, and it's kind of lovely to listen to all that and go, yeah, I've had a good life, right?
You really have.
How did you find that?
I can't even remember.
Yeah, you do your research, Kate, man. I'll tell you that.
Do you know what? You are the only person ever, no other journalist has ever made that connection.
Wow, what a great question.
And receives some truly memorable answers.
And Tom Cruise came, and Nicole Kidman. I go to him, listen, before you go, Tom, I just want you to know, if you fancy a foursome, I'm up for it, and I know Anne-Marie doesn't mind.
When I first dated my now husband, I joined a gym for, I'm going to say, £1,000 a year, just so I could go off and have a poo.
I got heckled once in Wales, and there was a bloke at the bar on crutches, and he actually said to me, I'd rather fall over than listen to this shit, and he threw his crutches at me and fell over. Can you believe that?
I've got some cat's ashes, I don't know who they are.
You've been catfished by your own cat.
Exactly, seriously, man.
Dad, have you thought about putting in a breakfast nook?
And my dad would think, I don't know, have you thought about getting your own fucking house?
How did you give a duck an orgasm, Craig?
It's good with them, you know. I know my way around a duck.
So if you fancy a sit-down with the likes of Adam Hills, Tom Allen, Anna Waddingham, Phil Tufnell, James Acaster and Ed Gamble, Daisy May Cooper and tons more, then join me every Tuesday and Friday. Search White Wine Question Time in your podcast app to subscribe and listen now. White Wine Question Time is a Stack production.